Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Steve Norman on behalf of Appellee Hewlett-Packard Corporation. I stand to reintroduce Mr. Stephen Schatz and Catherine Henderson. And also, I'd like to introduce the Court Mark Sonnenfeld of the Morgan Lewis firm.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Welcome back after such a, long delay.
May it please the Court, I'm Felipe Arroyo Robinson-Meda, reintroducing myself. Your Honors, I want to apologize in advance. I've developed a bit of a cough, and despite that I was able to suppress it magically during the prior argument, I apologize in advance, as I'm sure I will not succeed this time around. Your Honors, we're here, Mr. Espinosa is here, on a fairly narrow issue. We're seeking an investigative report that was prepared in connection with the dispatch of Mr. Hurd from the company at HP. And specifically, what we are investigating, what Mr. Espinosa is investigating, is the process that the board undertook in determining to pay Mr. Hurd tens of millions of dollars rather than separate him for cause. We style it currently. We haven't made any absolute determinations or conclusions yet. We style it currently as a mismanagement claim, as a waste claim. We see indicia of waste, and that has informed our investigation. We originally, in our 220 action, and as a precondition, before we filed our 220 action, we served, of course, our inspection demand on the company, and they did provide us with some board minutes and some expense reports and other information that we've described in our briefing. The question really that arose between the parties as to whether and to what extent a report that was prepared at the behest of the board by counsel to evaluate the facts and circumstances relating to the now familiar Allred letter that we discussed earlier and the accusations that were levied there in the letter, that the board ultimately resolved needed to be investigated so that the board could apprise itself about what steps it should take. And from our standpoint, the 220 action that we brought narrowly focused on the privilege claims and the work product claims that the company invoked to withhold the interim report from us. We're here, Your Honors, because the Supreme Court and the Courts of Chancery have told shareholders to utilize the tools at hand. The familiar phrase now, we don't want to over-invoke it here. We understand that folks may invoke it in different contexts. Here, we have a fairly narrow set of facts. As Your Honors heard earlier, we have a letter that details extraordinary conduct on the part of Mr. Hurd. Now, these are allegations, mind you. We're investigating. We haven't formed any final judgments, and neither has anyone else. But it's an extraordinary...
Forgive me for interrupting, but I have a couple of questions. Is it your contention that the order that's where you were denied access to the report, especially the special committee report or the Cummington report, was that the product of an error of law, or are you arguing abuse of discretion? What exactly is the nature of the claim here?
It is our perspective, Your Honor, that a de novo review does apply. And we have argued that there are numerous errors of law, so I can't backpedal from that. And certainly, I'm sorry, Your Honor, were you?
Go ahead.
Okay. Certainly, Your Honor, as we see it, the framework for resolving our issue, it's fairly well constructed now in Delaware, and we're not out on a limb on crafting new elements of a framework that didn't pre-exist. The so-called Garner factors, these are the factors that the Delaware courts, Chancery and Supreme, have embraced, originally a Fifth Circuit opinion. But by and large, what it does is it helps to outline when a party should be able to access information that is otherwise privileged. It's not an exception to the attorney-client privilege.
Well, before you go further, if we were to agree with your position that there was an error of law here, then what, in your view, should be the rule of law articulated in our holding? That is to say, is the rule of law that you're proposing that in any 220 case involving the kind of purpose that is alleged here, that is Section 220 purpose, that the special committee report should be produced as a matter of law, or is it that the Section 220, special committee report is producible as a presumptive matter unless reasons are shown not to, or is it some other rule?
Yeah, I would decline both of those formulations, Your Honor, in favor of understanding what the current formulation actually means. The errors of law.
I just want to know what formulation you're advocating.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Garner factors, which we're embracing, the terminology in the Garner factors, there are many, but three apparently are the most important to the courts of chancery and to the Delaware courts. I'm not putting the others aside, but for the moment, I'm going to highlight those that the courts have told us to highlight. Whether, you know, we're seeking a fishing expedition, which is not at issue. We're only seeking one report. And then there are the other two. And the construct, the rule
of
law.
I'm giving you an opportunity to answer my question in a sentence, maybe a paragraph, but not a page.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. The rule of law we'd advance is that if you satisfy the Garner factors, and the Garner factors should be read as they're stated, you have a colorable claim, and there's something that's unavailable from other sources and necessary to your cause, that you should get those documents. And so in that regard, we're not urging a different rule. Rather, we're imbuing the current rule.
You're saying it was misapplied. That is, the current rule was misapplied to these facts?
It was misconstrued, Your Honor, not just misapplied, but the terms in the rules themselves were imbued with meaning they don't have. So to that extent, they weren't just misapplied. For example, Your Honor, taking the whether and to what extent the report in our case is necessary to our cause, we've articulated what we're investigating. And we've articulated that what we're looking for is to understand what the board knew and when it knew it when it made this decision. And the Chancery Court, with the utmost and due respect, seemed to imbue the obligation that we should bear with an additional obstacle that somehow suggested that we had to show more, that there was a rule of law embedded in that terminology than what the language of the rules say. And so from our perspective, the rules say we have to show that that what we're investigating cannot be investigated thoroughly because the information we want in this report is unavailable from another source and it's necessary to our cause. We articulated both of those, but the Chancery Court seemed to require more. And the same is true.
Can I interrupt for a minute? What makes this report necessary to your cause?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's my fault. Protocol-wise, I forgot to reserve time at the beginning of the argument. And so I just point that out for the record. I apologize for that. Your Honor, in understanding how the board committed waste. For now, that's our tentative perspective on what occurred here. We have to know what the board knew and when it knew it. We can't just look ex post facto at the decision that was made. We have to understand the evaluative.
Wait a second. We're not talking about a lawsuit yet, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, we're not.
Okay. And if a lawsuit were filed alleging waste or any other sort of breach of fiduciary duty, there would be extensive discovery, no doubt. This is a 220 action, right?
This is a 220 action, yes.
Okay. And if I recall, the statute authorizes you to review documents that are necessary to your proper purpose, to get information that is necessary to an understanding of your proper purpose, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
It doesn't mean you get full discovery. And so what I'm trying to find out is, I understand the investigative report is something you'd be very interested in seeing, but I'm trying to find out why the other information you've been given doesn't provide enough information for you to now pursue anything that you feel is appropriate to pursue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Grimes and other cases specifically address this issue. What is it about investigating a deliberative process that's different from investigating an underlying claim? When we look at Grimes, for example, Your Honor, in Grimes, the same kind of argument was made that underlying...
No, no, don't tell me about another case. Tell me about what it is that you've gotten so far that is inadequate for you to be able to pursue a claim if you feel a claim is appropriate.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The information that we provided so far is nothing more than underlying source data. So we have expense reports and we have board minutes. And we've included...
And don't board minutes tell you something about what the board was considering and what its decision-making was?
Thank you. They don't tell us very much, but the one thing they do tell us, they're very sanitized, and we did give Your Honors copies of those in the record. The one thing they do tell us is what the board looked at, which was the interim report we're trying to get. It's not a secret. We both noted that the way we learned what the board considered in making this determination is in the minutes. And it's very plainly stated. They're not very long. The minutes don't say very much. They just say they looked at this interim report. And consequently, when we're trying to evaluate why the board made the decision that it made, why not separate them for cause and save tens of millions of dollars? The one thing we look to are the board minutes to say, well, here's what the board considered in making that determination. It's an interim report. And so we can't lift the lid at all, not even a little, on what the board evaluated unless we see what the minutes themselves say the board evaluated. And so it's necessary for us to understand how the board reached this
decision. There's no reason given in the minutes for the decision?
There's no reason in the minutes given for the decision as to why they terminated, I'm sorry, strike that, why they paid Mr. Hurd tens of millions of dollars as opposed to terminating him. Now, what you will hear, I believe on rebuttal, but what there has been argued in the opposing briefs, is that the company is given multiple reasons as to why they asked Mr. Hurd to resign.
All right, well, but it's critical to your position that, A, the minutes don't reveal anything or disclose anything about the board's deliberative process insofar as the decision to allow a termination without cause, correct?
It's a fair assessment, Your Honor.
B, the only information the board considered when it did make that decision was the report that's in dispute here. Is that part of your a critical part of your position?
That might be a little overstating it there, Your Honor. In the minutes themselves, the board is indicated to have done a number of things. Review the interim report, and then talk about potential disciplinary options and other potential steps. We don't know because the language is somewhat cryptic, but what's not in the minutes is the board has resolved to separate Mr. Hurd, and here's why we're going to pay him.
Well, the minutes do disclose that the board reviewed and presumably relied on the committee report.
The interim report. That's correct.
The internal report.
That's correct. And you're
and do the minutes disclose any other document upon which there was board reliance?
The report itself is styled the Standard of Business Conduct Investigation, or SBC, in the minutes.
I'm sorry.
Standard of Business Conduct.
Okay. And so you have that.
We have that, number one.
Okay.
And two, we presume it was reviewed at the meetings. But
This gets back to the question I initially asked you. Is your proposition of law that where the minutes don't disclose in any detail the board's reasoning process that led to the result that you're complaining of, that in a 220 action, an inquiring shareholder gets to look at everything that the board reviewed?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
That's not your rule of law.
No, Your Honor. We respect the Garner factors. We respect that there are multiple considerations that need to be adhered to in reaching the conclusion whether a report should be given.
You keep on wrapping yourself in Garner, but Garner is a very general test, and I'm trying to determine precisely what it is we need to decide in applying Garner.
Where?
So if your argument is not that the minutes don't tell you anything and therefore it's necessary or essential within the meaning of the 220 cases to see what the board looked at, then what is your proposition?
Your Honor, we would, in addition to Garner, we look at Grimes. We're not proposing a construct that's different or opposed to Garner. Rather, we look at Garner as applied and as interpreted by the cases that are out there. And
but you're asking us to interpret or apply Garner in a certain way, And to persuade us to do that, we need an intermediate proposition that gets us from Garner, which is a premise, to the conclusion that you're asking us to reach.
Fair enough, Your Honor. And here...
And what is the minor premise?
To us, Your Honor, where you have a claim that's not just colorable, but compelling in the manner and sort of the that we have arising from this kind of facts pattern, in our estimation, the way we would apply Garner is then looking to the other factors to determine the extent to which on a spectrum or scale that's provided in Garner, the report should be supplied. I don't believe
Is that the language that we should use in drafting an opinion?
In drafting an opinion, Your Honor, tracking the Garner factors would be completely fair. In our opinion, the Garner factors as written, the Garner factors, the terminology within the Garner factors, gives a sufficient legal construct for us to obtain the relief that we're seeking.
Is your proper purpose here the focus on the process by which the board decided to pay out this severance package? Let me finish my question. And if it's the focus on the process, does that not necessarily include the documents and information considered by the board?
I think yes to both, Your Honor. In our opinion, and respectfully disagreeing with the Vice Chancellor, our perspective is that that's precisely what we need to get done.
Well, is that the rule of law that you're advocating here?
Your Honor, if a mere statement of a proper purpose isn't our position in terms of justifying disclosure of information that otherwise might be subject to attorney-client privilege of work product. We respect that you need more than just a proper purpose. We respect that you need more than just to make a statement about the purpose and the connection between the report and the purpose. It goes far beyond that. The Garner factors, and putting aside the label to them, you should have to show more to obtain a report of the sort and nature that we're seeking. And so we do. We explain that we have facts here that are fairly compelling. And the colorable claim component of Garner says, you know, you better look more closely at what the claimed basis of need is. And moreover, look past just the need, and is there a reason to believe that there's a colorable claim? Now, admittedly, the word colorable the Vice Chancellor also seized upon language in the Garner opinion that's obviously colorable. You have an obviously colorable claim. And I think what that factor was designed to do is to give the courts a barometer as to, you know, the spectrum in terms of what you're asking for reconciled against what your purpose is. And so there are two gates. There's the colorable claim gate, and then there's the is this necessary and unavailable otherwise gate in Garner.
Well, let me go back to the necessary business. As I understand it, this interim report does not explain the board's consideration of possible options and why it should allow him to resign instead of be terminated for cause. Isn't that correct?
You're correct in reciting the representations made by Hewlett-Packard, Your Honor. We have no firsthand knowledge, as you might expect.
Right. Well, let's assume for a moment that they're being honest, okay? And so we know that a report has been prepared that looked into the underlying allegations of inappropriate behavior, correct? And that report was then reviewed by the board, and that the board had discussions and addressed the matter over several meetings, as I understand it, and reached a conclusion. Help me understand why the contents of that report will reveal anything about the board's deliberative process.
Well, the report coupled with the minutes evidenced the deliberative process. In other words, there doesn't have to be a topic heading in a report that says, here's our deliberative process, and for it to come under the rubric of what the deliberative process of the board was.
Maybe I don't understand what a deliberative process is, but it seems to me if a board meets and it's got four pieces of information in front of it, and there's a discussion and everybody has read those four pieces of information, and then the board takes a vote and the vote is X, the deliberative process constitutes A, what documents did you have? Did you read them? Did you discuss them? Did you take a vote? What was the vote? As opposed to, is it essential to know what was in each and every document specifically, as opposed to knowing that it was a general legal review of the allegations being made?
I think there is a spectrum there. I think there's a spectrum that goes from the definitive statement within a report that this was our deliberative process, here it is top to bottom, versus a more expansive view of what the deliberative process is. Here's what we did in deliberating how to reach our opinion.
But the interim report is not what the board did. It's what the attorneys and the investigators did to determine what the allegations were and how credible they were, right?
By the respectfully, Your Honor, if I may, no. The minutes evince that the board deliberated the facts in the report. So the board, the minutes coupled with the report, you have the minutes and you look to see when the board says we discussed what to do, they were deliberating, among other things, those facts that are reflected in that report.
You did ask for 5 minutes in rebuttal. You're into it. Did you want to save your time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You believe you've answered Justice Berger's question as fully as you can at this time?
I believe so, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Stephen Schatz. Good afternoon again. This case presents a not uncommon situation. The board receives an allegation of wrongdoing. It hires independent, respected counsel to conduct an investigation. It deliberates about the findings. And in this case, the outcome is the termination of Mr. Hurd. But the board here took it a step further, because they also publicly disclosed in great detail their rationale. You do not hear Mr. Arroyo devoting a heck of a lot of time for that, because let's see what HP said here.
Well, and let me give you an opportunity to help me understand what you mean by disclosed their rationale in full detail. They publicly disclosed the facts that underlay the decision to grant him a severance package and allow him to leave the company, resign and get a severance package. Did they announce in great deal, in detail publicly, why, given the two options they had available, for cause or not for cause, resignation and severance package, why they decided B instead of A or A instead of B?
Yeah, I believe they did implicitly, if I could elaborate.
Sure, that's what I'd like to know.
They said, first, that he did not violate the HP's policy against sexual harassment, but he did violate the lesser charge of violating the standards of business conduct. They did say that he had false expense reports that were designed to disguise a personal relationship, but they said it wasn't the amount. They said it went to the issue of credibility and integrity, which in their judgment and in Mr. Hurd's judgment made it impossible for him to continue as the CEO. So they didn't say for cause, not for cause, but they did articulate that he hadn't violated the most serious of the allegation. And that's why this is a far cry from those instances where the company essentially gives no rationale to their thought process. Grimes was a situation where even after this court said that if you make a demand on a board, they're entitled to a meaningful response, the company, 2 weeks shy of a year, thumbed their nose and gave a one-page response that gave no insight into their deliberations. Here, HP did precisely what a responsible company would do.
Mr. Schatz, I suppose if one were to be a contrarian, he or she might infer from the press release that the company sent out that the conduct that required Mr. Hurd to resign did not satisfy the standards for termination for cause. That's certainly one inference that can be drawn. Arguably, it could also be inferred, could it not, that the issue wasn't even addressed. No, I mean, I'm not suggesting one way or the other because I have no way of knowing what occurred.
Well, I will say this. In my judgment, a board faced with this situation doesn't have to you can always think of after the fact of something else that you might you might have said. That's what you know. That's what good lawyers do. They say, "Oh, you should have said this." But if you look not just at the press release, but at the conference call and the litany of information, I think it's fair to say that HP wasn't at all trying to hide the ball. It was trying to elucidate its rationale.
The conference call was transcribed.
It was, and it's, and produced. It's part of the it's part of the record. I think it's appendix 266 through 272, and it lays out in.
And the other side got that transcript.
It's part of the part of the record. So it's not just the information they received, but it's the explanation that they received with it, which is the public disclosures.
So, is it possible to say concisely that he was not terminated for cause, but given a severance package because? Can you fill in that sentence on the record?
I think that in their judgment, given the in their business judgment, given the nature of the offense, which essentially at bottom was essentially disguising a personal relationship, that the appropriate remedy was the one that they articulated. And by the way, they did get the terms of his severance and the severance provisions, so they could measure whether his conduct, in their judgment, met the standard or not for cause.
Appendix page 569 suggests that the vice chancellor was told that the interim report of Covington and Burling did not discuss the for-cause issue at all.
That is correct.
Did anyone ask him to review it in camera?
No, and it was clearly and unmistakably listed, appendix site 460 and 461 on our privilege log. They chose not to ask for it, never challenged it.
But he could have done so at a party's request.
He could have, and they chose not to.
Let me ask a slightly different question. Suppose that the report, the Covington report, were not drafted in the form that it was, that is, as a document created by attorneys and signed by attorneys, but rather as a document perhaps drafted by attorneys, but to be the product of and signed off by a committee of independent directors, which is the usual, or at least a not atypical form of confidential report. Would that make any difference to your side's position with respect to whether or not the report should have been produced under Section 220?
I think in the particular circumstances of this situation, no. Do I think the fact that it was a lawyer's report to the board, and then the board, and I know, and it's important for this court to understand, the HP's board met 8 subsequent times without Covington present to analyze and to discuss this matter. So the fact that it was a lawyer's report, yes, I do think it further buttresses the claim. But under these circumstances, where the company provided this information and the disclosures that they made here, with this posture. It's hard to fathom what their need is.
Just to make sure I understand correctly what you're telling me, in this particular case, the result should be the same, your side argues, whether or not there's a attorney-client privilege involved.
No, if I gave that impression, forgive me. I think a report, first, here, it's unmistakably attorney-client, and by the way, and it's also work product. He talks about the Garner documents, but this is, the Covington report is work product. It's unmistakably opinion work product. I think the Sato court says that there have only been two instances in which opinion work product had been overridden. There may be a few more additionally, but in this circumstance, we don't see how Vice Chancellor Parsons wasn't amply justified. With respect to, if I could answer the second part, with respect to whether if it was a report of the board, I'd have to analyze that situation to see whether that in fact constituted a, if you will, a disclosure that vitiated the privilege or not. But that's not this case.
I'm trying to figure out whether Covington and Burling was acting as investigators or acting as attorneys in light of the assertion of attorney-client privilege in the work product doctrine. And the reason I ask that is, if the ultimate gravamen of the attorney's work is a legal opinion on whether or not there was a sufficient factual basis to dismiss Mr. Hurd for cause, or there was only sufficient violation to work out a circumstance for him to resign and receive an appropriate severance package. We have a statement in the record that says the for cause wasn't discussed at all.
And he addressed neither. They addressed neither. They looked at the allegations in the...
Well, if they don't give a legal opinion, is it simply because they're lawyers that they get the protection of the attorney-client privilege?
They do give a legal opinion and provide their opinion with respect to the analysis of the interviews and whether to credit witnesses and weigh witnesses, exactly what lawyers do in the process of investigation. So their focus and the investigative report took the allegations in the Allred letter and then evaluated them. They did not discuss disciplinary action, but evaluation of witnesses. That's the kind of
Suggesting to the board how a witness would come across if called to the stand in light of litigation, whether or not they're credible, they make the kind of evaluation someone sends to a client after taking the deposition of someone else. Is that what you're talking about?
It would be, we've evaluated X fact, and here's the evidence, and here's our conclusion with respect to that allegation.
Mr. Schatz, just to follow up, it's not uncommon that... some of these internal investigation reports take the form of a committee of directors investigating the claims. Let's say there are four of them, and informing the board in the document that claims one and two are factually supported, three and four are not, but take no position on the legal implications. The board then reads the document, and then when the board meets, counsel are present at the board meeting, and then they advise the board on what the legal implications are with respect to claims one and two. In that circumstance, you've got a neat division between providing factual information to the board and legal advice. In this case, it's all rolled up into one.
Well,
the question is, should it make any difference?
It's clear with the... With respect to the deliberations of the board, the other counsel, not Covington, were present. I want to make sure that is understood. yes, their investigation involved facts, but an attorney's assessment of the facts and that and communicating that in the context of a threat of litigation, I think is clearly both attorney-client and work product. And I do want to address two things. First, I think the issue of need. This is not an issue about whether courts should encourage the use of 220. This court has an HP provided, in our judgment, more than sufficient information. The question is, in the circumstances of this case, should the privilege be overridden? Because when you really carefully analyze what they say if there's a credible basis for a proper purpose, which is the 220 claim, that coupled with the lack of discovery at 220 means that the work product, even opinion work product, and the attorney-client privilege should be overridden. Respectfully, under the circumstances of this case, we think that it would not be justified and would really have a profound impact on the ability of companies to self-police.
I hope you can appreciate that there's some broader concerns here that underlie some of these questions. This isn't the first time that this court has been asked to opine on whether or not an internal investigation report should be produced. Quite often that comes up in the context of an adversary that is a non-summary proceeding, either derivative or class action litigation. This may be the first time I'm aware of that it came up in a Section 220, but the question still is, under what set of rules should these documents be protected from disclosure or not? And the concern is that if we were to rule that simply lawyering up the document and crafting it the way it was crafted here protects it, that we could end up with the situation where everyone will do that and then claim that these documents can never be disclosed.
And that is not our position, nor was it Vice Chancellor Parsons' position. Take an extreme case. Take Grimes, for that matter, the Morgan Stanley case, Lamper's decision from Vice Chancellor Laster. In each instance, the board there gave no insight into what the thought process was. Here, Vice Chancellor Parsons looked at the materials that were provided, looked at HP's explanation, and said, under the circumstances here, we don't think the work product or attorney-client privilege should be overridden. Now, Mr. Arroyo talks about the Garner factors, but he doesn't devote much time either at argument or in his briefs about work product. And this material is unmistakably opinion work product, and there has to be a compelling need directed at a pivotal issue. And under those circumstances, given the information that we have, and given that it doesn't discuss the for-cause issue, under those circumstances, we don't think it meets either test. In fact, he went so far, and we think he was correct, that even if you viewed it as fact work product, it didn't meet that test because there wasn't a substantial need given the amount of information and the disclosures that were made. He wasn't attempting to render a global rule.
Is it correct then, do I understand your position correctly, that if there had not been this additional information out there, such as the conference calls and the press releases and all of that, the outcome of this case could have been different?
It might have been different. It's not this case. But certainly the fact that HP made those disclosures under these circumstances, and remember, this is an investigation. He hasn't even decided to sue or not. I think his assessment, the court's view that he had sufficient information under 220 to make his own assessment at this point, I think was more than amply justified. And I think that's really what's critical here. Boards of directors are faced increasingly with instances where it's important for them to say self-police. So they here, HP did the absolutely responsible thing. It hired one of the finest law firms in the country to provide a report. It then disclosed its reasons. It did not anticipate the precise words "not for cause," but the reasonable implication was, under the circumstances here, no sexual harassment, not the amounts in question, but the issues of credibility and integrity. This is implied in that is the judgment that we think that this is the appropriate course of action. There may be some instances where that. Where that is not sufficient, but under these circumstances here, we think Vice Chancellor Parsons was well justified. And the ramifications of essentially an automatic rule is that companies will, particularly in the gray areas, forbear from doing investigations, or they'll tell their lawyers, don't write anything down. And by the way, that's not me talking, that's the United States Supreme Court in the Upjohn decision. But as I can reinforce as a practical matter, that's what happened. We're not asking for a global rule, but we think under the circumstances here, Vice Chancellor Parsons was more than amply justified. The other cases, instances in which the report were provided, are either instances in which the company thumbed their nose and provided no information, in effect, into their reasoning, or there was an instance in which that's both Grimes and Morgan Stanley, or instances in which you were looking at a general commercial transaction with no work product component, and when you looked at the procedural posture, the company, the plaintiff hit the wall. I think Vice Chancellor Parsons' decision that under the circumstances here, that they had enough was sufficient. He can't overcome, and when you're assessing the issue of need, I think it's important that you consider the following. If he's looking for information about what her did, he already conceded, first page of his brief below, that he had enough information. If he wants information with respect to the for-cause issue, the Covington report doesn't address it. Either way, this is not an instance in which the privilege should be overridden. Respectfully, the ramifications here are significant. The logical extension of their position is, if you do an investigative report, even at this stage with this posture, it's essentially the work product and attorney-client privilege are overridden. We think that would be a departure, a substantial departure from prior case law. The Covington report under these circumstances are not necessary and essential. He certainly didn't have a substantial need, and he truly certainly didn't have a compelling need, which was directed to a pivotal issue. Unless there's any other questions.
Thank you very much.
Timed my cough drops, I hope, correctly, Your Honors. Just a few points. In rebuttal, the company suggests that there aren't cases where a work product doctrine is overcome, and you know, in circumstances such as this one. The Grimes case, the case we heavily rely upon, is no secret. It's discussed at length there, and just like in our case, there was a report that was at issue. There was an assertion of privilege. The issues really were right in line with the issues that we're grappling with today. Moreover, this is important. This Morgan Stanley case, a very critical case for showcasing the deliberative process that I discussed earlier with the court, it really accentuates the why reports can be necessary. Even reports that that underlie an investigation prepared by counsel. It's in the opinion itself. And let me really punctuate something here, because this is, to me, an important point. The Morgan Stanley case showcases the deliberative process and when and to what extent it should be highlighted in a 220 action. It's pretty important, you know, and I want to make sure it's very clear. That case doesn't, it's not a privilege case, and it's not a work product case. So it isn't our role here today that we want to make sure that course, that case is properly understood in the context in which we're appearing today. 220 action, privilege, and work product, that's Grimes. And you look at Morgan Stanley, what it does is it really showcases the deliberative process and what the difference is between underlying wrongdoing, like perhaps of the sort that Mr. Hurd is accused of, and the deliberative process that was the precursor to a board decision that was ultimately rendered.
Will you be responding to Mr. Schatz's point on the issue of need, where he made 2 points? If the question is what Hurd did, you have that. And secondly, if the issue is for cause, the report doesn't address it.
Absolutely, Your Honor. First, as to Mr. Hurd, the underlying wrongdoing, when he says we have that, we certainly have material that directly relates to it. And I think for the purposes of this argument, we can observe that we have materials that relate to his expense reports, and apparently that's where some of the wrongdoing occurred. Of course, we don't have a direct tie to what the board looked at in the expense reports that we were provided, and that's where you get to need. When we look to the minutes to see what the board evaluated in its deliberative process, the minutes tell us what they looked at. It doesn't say anything about, strike that. What it points us to, and why we're here, is because it points us to the interim report. And, you know, it occurred to me a point that seems to have been lost, at least somewhat, in the flavor of the argument that I earlier made. There's a lot more that we've learned, rightly or wrongly. We put this in the appendix. Press reports themselves, you know, we're shareholders seeking information about what our board did and why it paid tens of millions as opposed to separate someone for cause. And we have all the reasons why, respectfully, Mr. Hurd needed to be separated. I'm not using the word fired. I'm looking for a word that says we know that the board reached the conclusion that he could no longer stay. He could no longer lead. And counsel referred you to that transcript of a conference call. And if you look there, you'll see all those reasons why he could no longer lead. That's not what we're investigating. We're not investigating the narrow issue why he could no longer lead. That counsel has referred you to transcripts that is addressed by the company. The greater question is all this stuff that was known, improprieties associated with expense reports, violating the standard of business conduct. Without this report, we cannot evaluate why the board, knowing what it knows, knowing what it knew, apparently, and disclosing what it disclosed, why it elected to pay Mr. Hurd tens of millions of dollars instead of firing him for cause. There isn't any, while we understand that they've given us their basis for why he needed to no longer be with the company, we don't have any opportunity to evaluate that critical, pivotal inflection point. When counsel says we haven't spent any time on work product, I respectfully disagree. It's in our briefs. But more to the point, the Grimes case certainly addresses work product and the circumstances. Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. I apologize. I breached that last time, and I'm going to try not to do this.
That's all right. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.